Welcome to the Philharmonia audio commentary. This is a Owen Tracy recording at 7:01 GMT. Today is November 9th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. But before we get into those themes, let's have a look at what's been happening in the markets just over the last week, and it has been exciting, to put it mildly. We've seen some really rather exciting moves in the precious metals, where we've seen silver get up to in excess of $16, but it has pulled back from that level. We've seen gold reach new highs and also pulling back a little bit from those levels. So we're seeing consolidations beginning in some of these precious metals, having seen them break upwards from long-term, consolidations that have been in excess of a full year, and in some cases almost two, where we've seen them break upwards. And now they look like they're about to consolidate in what has been so far relatively volatile trading action, but actually quite tight consolidations. Of the weakest of them, platinum today is down $40. It posted a technical key day reversal on Wednesday. It held up a bit yesterday, but it's following through on the downside here today. Platinum, more than any of the other of the precious metals, is best bought following reactions. So that will be one to keep an eye on to see when it starts to find support. I don't see any reason why platinum should be reversing meaningfully, given the positive action that we're seeing right across the precious metals sector. And it's probably just a short-term move. Looking at the dollar has been weak right throughout this week, and although firmer in here today, has been significantly weaker throughout the week. One of the more important moves actually happened today. You have the pound getting substantially weaker against the dollar in here today. It hit a high of 2.1162 earlier on today, but it's now below $2.09. So that's a very large move just on the day, and it's also posting a key day reversal, and it's probably capping the advance of the pound in the short term. It's primarily, I think, on the news that, well, the rumors, I think, is better, it's better termed, that Barclays could be writing down as much as £10 billion. Now, there was further commentary on this rumor earlier on today, where the management came out and told their employees that there was no truth in it. But it is a measure of just how nervous markets are that the pound has moved this much on the back of just that rumor. And over the coming days, I'm sure we'll get the truth of it one way or the other. The energy sector has also been hitting new highs this week. It was up to $98 at one point during the week, and currently at 96. We're seeing a bit of a consolidation below this roundophobic or psychological $100 level. Natural gas broke up last week above the $8 level, fell back below that level this week, but is pretty much back up there to in here today. It's up 22 cents. It's at $7.93. Today was also an important day for a number of the grains because you had the USDA report. Soybeans is up 10 and three quarters, so it is breaking upwards from this consolidation that it had around $1,000 or $10. Oats sold off really aggressively earlier on today, but actually made up the vast majority of that loss. And of the four main grains, that being corn, soybeans, and oats and wheat, oats has the pattern that looks the most technically like it's going to break upwards, but it does need to sustain a move above this $3 level to indicate that that is about to happen, and it hasn't managed that just yet, but certainly something to keep an eye on. So oats and soybeans certainly the leaders in that area. There was also news on the cotton front because the crop is likely to be larger than expected, but actually the cotton price has held up reasonably well, so maybe not unexpected there. Looking at some of these other markets, stock markets are right now in a consolidation, are at the very best. They reached peaks earlier last week and throughout this week have been in a corrective phase. The Hang Seng was down in excess of 5% one day this week, although it has steadied up above this 28,000 level. The Nikkei was weak in here today and has continued to be weak throughout the week. and it's above that 15,000 level once more. The DAX was relatively unchanged in here today, but is coming off from this little bit of a consolidation we've seen over the last 2 weeks. And the IBEX in Spain, which so many people had written off completely in July, August, is actually holding its gain to new high ground, which is quite an interesting move. That other market in Europe, Ireland, which had been the focus of some pretty heavy property speculation, is actually breaking down to new lows, and it is probably one of the weaker markets in Europe right now. And that is something to watch for when we see financial shares starting to turn once more. Ireland is more than likely going to turn with them because it's being priced like a banking index. The bond market is firming up in here today with a bit of strength in the dollar and increasing speculation that we're going to see further rate cuts. Last week, we had the Fed make their 25 basis point cut, and they said that the risks to growth and of growth against inflation were relatively balanced. And that was them trying to talk down the potential for further rate cuts at the next meeting. However, since then, we've had such an accumulation of bearish news from the banking sector, and the banking sector is really very weak in here right now, that speculation has risen once more that we're going to see further rate cuts and probably a rate cut at the next meeting, just because the economic news is coming out so very weak. A theme that we have started to talk about much more over the last couple of months is the wobbly West versus the enterprising East. And there are a number of reasons for this. Primarily, it's because the Asian economies have taken over, ex-Japan, have taken over the mantle for GDP growth globally right now. And we're seeing stock markets, particularly in the USA and Europe, and indeed in Japan, starting to lag, and they've been lagging for the last couple of months, while we've seen markets right across Asia improving and moving on easily, breaking through their July highs, and some of those markets doing exceptionally well and moving on significantly beyond those July highs. India and China, of course, being the main markets in that region, and certainly the ones that are leading the market upwards, or have led the market upwards over the last couple of months, although it has to be said that all stock markets right now are in a consolidation phase. But wobbly West versus enterprising East. Over the last 10 years in the West, we have probably built far more houses than were needed, whereas in the East, they are investing in infrastructure at a rate which is beyond the comprehension of just about everybody. But we're seeing the greatest urbanization in the history of the world happening right now, today, in India and in China. And they're moving millions of people, hundreds of millions of people into the cities, and those cities have yet to be built. And they will be built over the next 10 to 15 years. Whereas in the West, we have concentrated on building homes and second homes and speculating on homes where there wasn't actual physical demand to fill them. And a number of countries now are having a housing slowdown, whereas in the East, you're having a building boom, which is likely to suck up commodities from around the world for the foreseeable future. Not only because they need those houses for the people moving from the country to the city, but also because they need those houses for their children. The demographic profiles of the enterprising East means that they have vast numbers of very young people about to enter the workforce, whereas in the West, most countries have a declining birth rate. Excuse me, I'm just going to cough in here. Sorry. So that is another major impact on the way we should be investing. David did a long audio yesterday on the dollar weakness that we're witnessing right now. And that is something that is also tying in to the wobbly West and enterprising East theme. In the West, we have central banks competing to devalue their currency. Now, right now, and over the last 2 or 3 months, the US dollar has been the weakest currency of the major G7 basket of currencies. But no country wants a strong currency for very long, particularly because of the competitive nature of globalization, and because countries want to protect the consolidated earnings of their major exporters. But what we are seeing is you have the dollar accelerate, or certainly, I can't say accelerating because that's not true, but it is certainly moving down faster than it has done. And that is something that is certainly creating optimal conditions for the precious metal markets. It's also creating good conditions for just about all of the commodities. But when we contrast the performance of currencies across the world, we have the US dollar, which is quite weak, and we have the currencies of Europe and the pound and the Swiss franc, the Japanese yen. None of those large economic areas want to have a strong currency. And they are, for the moment, willing to accept the fact that their currencies have appreciated versus dollars. But when you look at those currencies relative to some of the Asian currencies, they haven't gone up nearly as much. Most of the Asian currencies are well below where they were before the Asian financial crisis. Of all those currencies, the Singapore dollar is the one that has appreciated the most over the last sort of 10 years. But what we can say without doubt is that if there is room for an area or a basket of currencies to appreciate, it is in that Asian area. Those economies are in much better condition. They're creditor economies versus the debtor nations that we have in the West. They have the GDP growth and the growth of their populations and infrastructure, and it's much better regulated this time around rather than the way it had been prior to the Asian financial crisis. That means that those currencies, the Asian currencies, are much more likely to appreciate in real terms versus all other currencies over the next 10 to 15 years than we are going to see from the what we could term the reserve currencies of the world in here today. And again, that feeds back into the wobbly West and enterprising East theme, where we see the emergence of the Asian economies. The next part of the next iteration, I guess, would be in the per capita consumption of commodities. Because in the 70s, during the last commodity boom, you had only about 700 or 800 million people competing for the commodities of the world. But with globalization and the accession of so many billions of people in Asia and indeed across the Middle East into the global economy, you have a great many more people competing for the same number of resources, and that is bound to push prices for those things upwards. Given the fact that the per capita consumption of basic commodities such as copper are so far below where they are in the West, is an indication that they only have to go up just a small piece before you put extreme pressure on the infrastructure to be able to supply those commodities globally. That's probably not going to happen right now. We see, for example, copper is consolidating in here, and it's been range trading for much of the last 18 months, but its secular bull trend is still very much intact. And we can say exactly the same thing for just about all of the industrial commodities, and without doubt in the energy sector, because the per capita consumption of these commodities is going upwards in the 4 to 5 billion people who live right across the Asian region and into the Middle East and South America. And that is putting enormous pressure on the ability of miners to supply them. Those miners that have survived through the triple waterfall bear market that lasted up until 6 years ago were cautious people. And it has taken quite some time to realize that we're in a new super cycle, and commodity cycles have generally lasted quite a bit longer than other cycles. And given that this is a global cycle, which is pretty unlike, and I think we can say without doubt on this occasion that it is different this time because there are so many more people involved, that we're still at the early parts of this move. And more importantly, all those companies that have survived and survived by cutting back and by mining their best assets when the price was low and moving into lower quality assets when the price was high, so that they maintained their ability to supply the market at a relatively good price. They are conservative people and they haven't been spending huge amounts of money on exploration. They've been concentrating more on consolidation and buying up the proven assets that other companies have been able to survive on. So we are seeing an enormous amount of consolidation right across the commodity sector right now, and we're seeing BHP and Rio dueling with each other as we speak. But while that is certainly good for our portfolios in the short term, it is also good in the longer term because while these metal or these mining companies are competing with each other to buy one company or another, they're increasing their own personal reserves, but they're certainly not increasing the global capacity to mine these minerals. And that is helping to keep supply lower than it could be over the medium to longer term, whereas we know for a fact that demand will continue to rise. And we can say that we know it for a fact because while we still have doubts in the West as to just how much economies like China and India can grow, those countries are under no doubts themselves. They are actively participating in competition to secure assets, secure reserves right around the world to fuel the growth that they know they're going to have over the next 10, 15, 20 years. And that is also an indication of the enterprising East versus the wobbly West. Because in the West, so far in this commodity super cycle, the vast majority of analysts have been pretty reluctant to believe that there was the potential for commodities to rise as they have and to continue doing so. Whereas in the East, we've had a number of governments actively supporting industry in their own countries to go out there and secure assets, and they've been doing it on a political scale as well. And that is something that we can probably anticipate continuing. In the energy sector, it's even more important because we are seeing a continued trend towards nationalization, and it will be an increasingly difficult energy or sector to participate in because so many of the companies that have assets in the ground have those assets or reserves in a country which is politically unstable. That makes countries which have large amounts of reserves in the ground for just about all commodities and that are politically stable in that they have respect for property rights, they have preferably democratic governments, they are going to have a premium on their reserves for any company that wants to invest in them. And the leaders there, of course, are Canada and Australia. And their stock markets are reflecting their performance, and so are their currencies. The Canadian dollar went through parity a couple of weeks ago. It's at 94 cents right now. And the Australian dollar is quickly coming up towards parity. It's weaker in here today, and it may be in need of some consolidation. But I think it would be unlikely that the Australian dollar isn't going to go through parity with the dollar at some point in the medium to longer term. Looking at some of the other themes, when we look at the wobbly West, and that's not a flattering term, I will be the first to admit, But we see that in the West, we've been flooding the market with liquidity. And we've done that to bail ourselves out of just about all the financial problems that we've had over the last 15 to 20 years. During the Asian financial crisis, there was a massive amount of liquidity entered the market. We had the Russian debt default, the tequila crisis, that was the Mexican peso crisis. We had Y2K, which was an absolute nonsensical panic. And of course, we had 9/11. We even had last year in May, we had that big injection of liquidity following the medium-term correction, and again, just recently with the credit crunch. And this is something that is helping to support stock markets right now, but it can't go on in perpetuity. The reason that central banks have been lowering interest rates and supporting the markets is because they are much more afraid of deflation than inflation. There is certainly the perception that they can handle inflation by raising interest rates and tightening up, but the experience of Japan shows that it is much more difficult to combat deflation. So what we've seen following 9/11 was that the Fed lowered interest rates and cut them to the bone and flooded the market with liquidity. Following the bursting of the Japanese bubble, they continued to raise interest rates well beyond the peak in that bubble, and they threw the economy into a deflationary spiral, which I think we can say safely that it is only really just starting to move upwards from right now, with the caveat of some political uncertainty and the slowdown in reforms. But the central banks around the world were very much aware of the mistakes that Japan had made, and they would have done anything to defray the risk of throwing their own economies into a deflationary spiral. And the Fed was the first among those, and they cut interest rates to the bone and gradually raised them once more. 2003 marked the bottom in the government bond yield. And when you look at that long-term chart, and I think anyone would be well advised to go into the chart library and just look at as many long-term charts as you possibly can, because of the perspective that they give us. What we saw was that when interest rates hit their bottom, yields hit their bottom, following an excessive 20-year bear market. And we are now in another period where interest rates are coming down, and I think it's getting increasingly likely that we're going to see another rate cut at the next Fed meeting, and we may even see another one after that. However, I think it is also very unlikely that we're going to see interest rates go back to that 1% that we saw in 2003, if my memory serves me correctly. And the next time that they start to move upwards, they're probably going to rise higher. At the moment, we are in a phase where inflationary fears or risks are largely being ignored. We have oil reaching all-time highs, and we have commodity prices generally starting to push up, particularly the grain prices starting to push up once more. But because of the fear of recession and economic contraction and the large amount of uncertainty that has been associated with this credit crunch, we are seeing interest rates being cut at the moment, and that is fueling future inflationary problems. So once they come to the end of this cycle, it will mark more than likely a higher low in the progression of the bottom in the yield price and the beginning of a new uptrend. The next time they start to rise interest rates, they will probably go above the peak that we've recently seen. And that is a cycle that we can anticipate continuing for a good many years forward. We will see small cycles where we have disinflationary pressures. Those will be extremely good for stock markets. But as interest rates start to rise once more, they will increasingly start to rein in stock market performance. And when inflation does become a headline problem, then we'll see central bankers when growth, excuse me, starts to become a problem, we'll see central bankers declare a partial victory over inflation, just as they did recently, and they'll lower interest rates once more. And that is a secular theme, and it will continue going forward. Hand in hand with a commodity bull market, you're almost certainly going to have inflation. They pretty much go hand in hand because if the price of everything is going up, that is necessarily inflationary. It also puts pressures on stock markets because if you have gradually rising interest rates over the long term, that makes government bond yields much more competitive against the performance of stock markets. So we should see rising dividend yields across stock market indices. However, with the growth that we're seeing in Asia, and we have seen dividend yields rising there considerably, but there is the potential for the next really big bubble to develop in Asian stock markets, purely because they have that genuine growth and they have the potential and they necessarily have to grow the size of their infrastructure and put in place everything that will be needed to supply jobs and homes for their massively young populations. That is going to be the growth area going forward. Another theme that we've started to develop recently has been the outperformance of some of the big technology firms. Now, the Nasdaq has been pulling back over the last couple of days, and that was, I think, on partly because of some negative earnings reports. I think Cisco was the main headline yesterday or the day before. But what we have seen is a move to outperformance by technology shares. And that is something that is important, particularly when we look at the performance of the Nasdaq relative to the S&P. And it's broken upwards from a 5-year base formation. And one of the things that these economies in the East are noticeably lacking is access to high technology. The West still has an edge, and which is likely to it's likely to be able to maintain at least for the next 10 or 15 years, in that they have a much greater access to high technology in the fields of aerospace or weapons or in the internet or anything to do with wireless technology or telecommunications. And with the massive funds that are at the availability or are available, excuse me, to the central banks of the East, where we see a great number of sovereign wealth funds being created over the last 5 to 10 years, it wouldn't be too surprising to see a number of these funds attempting to buy out large technology funds to gain access to that technology for their own countries. In China, you see that the government are plowing a lot more money into research and development right now. Because you have very lax laws on the protection of patents, you don't see a very many Western companies exporting their top-end products there. When I was in Shanghai, I saw a billboard which was advertising the Mach 3 Gillette razor, but it was the razor that we'd been using here 10 years ago, and it was a billboard that had Tiger Woods and Thierry Henry on it advertising this razor. But again, it's 10-year-old technology. And the Eastern nations, they're very much aware that they have an edge when it comes to manufacturing, and they have an edge when it comes to low-cost manufacturing of just about anything. But they are behind the curve when it comes to the production of high technology and the development of new technologies. And that is something that they are likely to be very keen to invest in going forward. So we can anticipate some greater or renewed interest in the technology sector, and the ones that are most likely to perform are the businesses that have proved that they have a viable business over the last 7 or 8 years, which has been in the middle of a bear market for technologies. But with that theme, I will wish you a good evening, and wish you a very good good weekend. Thank you very much for your time.